Welcome to NB Publishers Book Nook. In this episode, we'll be listening to Pippa Hudson's conversation with ultra-endurance cyclist Grant Lottring about Riding Life, a book which tells his incredible story. Pippa sat down with Grant in a hustling and bustling Exclusive Books, where he shared more about his journey.
I first met Grant in my radio studio in, as I said, 2015, 2016, and your publicist, Leslie, had mailed us to say, you've got to get this guy on the show, the story's amazing, and she kind of gave us the pricey version, and if I can use a term my teenagers would use, it felt a little bit extra. I'm like, there's no way. Like, in between all the bump, we'll find a story, but there's no way all of that is true. But it actually was, and look, from reading the introduction to the book, I see I wasn't the only journalist who was a little skeptical up front, because it sounded like you were laying it on so thick, that this guy's been snatched back from the brink of death and he's broken all these dozens of bones, and you're like, okay, they're laying it on a bit thick. But they worked. I mean, that is literally what happened. And of course, I'm betting there are a lot of journalists and a good few doctors who are eating their words right now. I mean, Grant, you have that experience fairly regularly of walking back into a hospital room and saying to a doctor, hey, I'm here, I just came to say thanks for the role you played in saving me. How often do their jaws hit the floor and say, I can't believe you're here alive and walking, let alone cycling?
Yeah, it still happens. The last one I can recall now was late last year. I was fortunate to speak to a audience of surgeons, general surgeons, from a different hospital group. And a few of them afterwards, they were a bit, not skeptical, but they really could not believe that I've had the recovery that I've had. I think that's the main thing. It's more about the recovery, and that's why I focus so much on the role that your mind plays in your physical strength and your recovery when you go through trauma or a physical event. I do get that quite a bit. But I think initially, Pippa, I really just wanted to... You know, it's better to have someone praise you than you try and praise yourself. So I chose to take that route and rather downplay it and let my legs do the talking, so to speak, which is what happened.
So we'll talk a little bit about what actually happened. But before we do that, I want to know a little bit about Grant before the accident. I mean, Nikki's absolutely right in saying it wasn't just your physical death that day. It was the end of life as you knew it before. And it's very clear reading your book, it was the end of a direction in life that you were, not that you were on a wrong track or anything like that, but there was a fundamental shift in how you felt about life and what you wanted to achieve in your life. So tell us about Grant Lottring before the accident.
Yeah, I would say if I had to sum it up in one sentence, no pun intended, but life was riding me. I was not riding life at that point. Yes, I had a good career, excuse me, but I never knew what my purpose was in life. I never felt I really achieved anything significant that had a positive impact on people around me. And that to me was always this empty space in my life. At that stage, I was single, and you know, so I wasn't married, I don't have children, and you know, so there's, you can't really express yourself through anyone in particular. And I was just going through life, you know, so I see it as something that happened for me, not to me. And it really was the best day, or the best thing that could have happened for me, because at that point, yes, I was doing my cycling and I was doing the racing, because you want to achieve something and you want to do your sport and excel at that. But I was definitely not living my purpose. Definitely not. I was seeking that. I had no idea what it was. And after that accident, it became so clear.
I mean, it has to be said there are easier ways to find it, Grant, than hurtling into a rock face and breaking 22 bones.
I suppose.
I mean, before we talk about the event itself, cycling, I mean, it was obviously something you were good at and you recognized you were good at from a young age. And it was something that you sort of found gave yourself a sense of identity reading your book that allowed Grant the teenager to work out, well, who am I and what do I want to be? This is something I'm good at. It's something that sets me apart from others. And yet you gave it up when you were 21. I was intrigued by that. I mean, was that... Talk to us about that decision, because, I mean, you came back to it, thank heavens, and it's ultimately led you here. But what was it that made you walk away from it at 21?
Yeah, so I discovered cycling as a young boy, and I could immerse myself in it. I could excel in it. And it was all up to me, my own focus, my own determination. I was not good in team sports. So that helped me. And I struggled to fit in at school and everything. And I could express myself through my sport of cycling. So I totally immersed myself in it. That's all I did. For one, I didn't have a single girlfriend right through my school years. Not one. Can you believe it? I was always on my bike. And everybody always said, like, where's Grant? Oh, he's probably out riding his bicycle, you know, which was true. And then by the time I hit 21, I'd already done my military service. I rode for the fence as well. And I turned professional. My dream was to race in Europe, but we were still banned back then, hence the fake racing license and all those things. But when I was fined out and I had to come back, and I thought, you know what, you've achieved everything you could have on your bike, other than racing in Europe, which is not going to happen. At that stage, I didn't think, I mean, this was 1989. Had I known in 3 years' time we would be able to compete internationally, I would have probably stuck it out. But I decided to hang up the wheels. I had my colors, I had achieved everything I wanted to, and just live a normal life and start going out again and meeting people and start putting on some weight and some muscle and that type of thing, you know, like... I was a little bit behind the curve there in terms of the social life, so I had to catch up, which, yeah.
And catch up you did. But then in your 30s, you found your bike, yeah, and you found your bike again and started racing at a really professional, competitive level. Mm. So let's take us to July 2013, the Italian Alps, a race called La Leggendaria Cialigol. Your description of the start line of that race, I mean, it's heart attack inducing for a reader, Grant. You are there, you're in peak condition, you've trained for this, you're fit, you think you know what you're in for, and that race sets off and you realize, this is not what I thought I was signing up for. Take us back to that moment. I mean, you were trying to keep up with a super fast, super aggressive start to the race, which was not the way you planned on starting, and I know you're a big planner. Grant likes to plan for every eventuality, foresee the race, walk the route, know what's coming.
Yes.
This was not what you expected, was it?
Not at all. And that was my first race in Europe since 1989. A lot has changed. And I remember standing on the start line, and a few guys to my left was the under-23 world champion. Now, we started in the same racing group, even though I was obviously in a different age category. My hotel was just around the corner. This was in the Piazza in Trento. Beautiful square, cobblestones everywhere and cathedrals and stuff. And we're standing there. I just tootled down from the hotel straight to the start line because I figured we got a 10-kilometer neutral zone, more than enough time to warm up, nothing to worry about. But when that gun went, yes, it was a neutral zone, but we just went full gas from the start. And the level of racing in Europe is so high. We've got 100 guys here that could potentially win. There was maybe 500. And we just raced through that city at the rate of knots. We were jumping over speed humps, just like you see in the Tour de France, literally. Straight over traffic circles and you know, it's just adrenaline. And in that moment, I thought, like, oh man, this is what I lived for when I was a youngster. And here I am able to do it again, and I'm 44 years old. What a joy, what a privilege, and I loved every second of it, even though it was heart stopping.
Because also, in case you didn't know, he's a tiny bit competitive, just a little. And so there you are, I mean, keeping up with this frantic pace, this mixture. I mean, I loved reading that section of the book, Grant, the description of the mix of the adrenaline and the excitement of being there, but also this terror of, we are going so much faster than I thought we were going to. 45 minutes into that race, the crash. I mean, what do you remember of the moments immediately before you went off the road and over that water dish and into the rock face? Do you have a clear recollection of the lead up?
I do have a clear recollection of that final corner, absolutely. Coming from the little town at the top, what I do remember from that was it was a very narrow little road through a typical Italian village. Narrow streets. people standing in their doorways cheering as you come through. And over the top there was a sign with a minus 17 degree little board pointing with a car on it. And I knew, okay, this is going to be fast. And we just flew down there. That I can't remember so much because you're literally just glued to the wheel in front of you. But as we entered that corner, there was no one in front of me. They had all moved over that way, and I was still on this side of the road. And I realized I've entered this corner at the wrong angle, and you're going so fast. The last time I looked at my computer, I was doing 66 kilometers an hour. That I can remember clearly. And I looked up, and I just saw this corner, and I saw that rock wall. And I saw the water, and my bike just twitched in the water, and I just went straight. And I can remember clearly just thinking, don't hit your head. And I bunny hopped the bike literally over the ditch and just crashed straight into the with my shoulder. I can remember that
shoulder,
very clearly.
Not your head. Yeah.
Very, very clearly, yeah.
I mean, if you'd hit it with your head, you wouldn't have survived, Grant. I think that's probably
indisputable. Yeah. I doubt it.
But that shoulder took a beating.
Much.
And to say, I mean, the list where you set out the injuries, the list is a page long in this book. Every line a different broken bone, an artery, a collapsed lung, all those injuries, and most painful to realize that you weren't actually knocked out. You were conscious. So you hit that wall.
Yes, I was. I was conscious. Yeah.
And, I mean, the pain you must have been in, absolutely excruciating, before another cyclist then rode over you and broke your femur.
That's
on top
hard.
Of that.
Yeah.
I mean, Grant, that, how long was the wait before people started stopping to help? I mean, even then, it was very little that could be done on scene. But did you have moments of clarity lying there where it was just you going, taking stock of what had just happened?
There was. The funny thing is when, you know, it's almost like everything plays off in slow motion. And I think it's because of the severity of the incident that my physical body was starting to shut down, so then your subconscious mind, I think, starts to, it just continues, really. So I was able to make sense of what was going on around me. I had no extent how severe my injuries were, no idea of the extent of that. But I can recall quite clearly the faces above me, the guy's hand on my neck, was the blood was everywhere, and those type of things I remember very, very clearly. Time-wise, you know, it felt like forever, but it wasn't. And obviously, I wanted the facts in the book to be very, very accurate. Fortunately, the doctor came to see me in hospital, and he told me what happened. He gave me an idea of the timeline that was on the road that saved my life. And I was also able to connect with a few guys on Facebook. One is in New York, one or two others in Europe, just to get their recollection of it. Went back to all the comments on Facebook at that time, to make sure. So around about 10 minutes was the timeline before the referee's car pulled up and the head of ICU was in that car.
I mean, thank heavens for you, he was.
Yeah, yeah. But also, one of the other guys, a South African who was there the whole time, Christo Groenewald, he's got a bit of a medical background, and he said the quality of care that I received there on the road, he said it was remarkable. It was incredible how well prepared they were to treat me, just to get my heart to start beating again.
I mean, incredibly moving to read that section because, as you mentioned, I mean, Christo stops. He's racing just as hard as anybody else, but he stops. He recognizes, hey, that's the other South African I met the other night. I'm going to stop and help. Uli, the New Yorker, complete stranger, he doesn't know you, stops to help, sacrifices his race position, describes in the book literally holding your arteries together, which probably played a role in saving your life. And a fellow cyclist with medical training stops to help. All these people who didn't know you, who, you know, gave up their own race position and time to stop and help. I mean, you would like to think that anybody would do the same for somebody else in that position. But when you think about how competitive this sport is and how competitive that race was, it was a big thing for them to do that.
Very much so, yeah. And Uli still commented on Facebook afterwards because he went to the hospital the next day as well to just check up on me. He actually left his racing gloves there for me in a bag, and they were covered in my blood. I still have them at home, actually.
Okay.
And he said he couldn't believe how many guys just raced past. He yelled at a few guys to stop to help, and he said they just raced past. But I think you cannot blame anybody in that moment. You're racing. Everybody's coming down there so quick. Most of them probably didn't even see me lying there because of the speed that we were going down there. So just the fact that there were a few people that stopped, and yet they were medically, one was a doctor, the other one had medical experience, it's just unbelievable, you know. So yeah, that's humanity for you, you know, very much so.
Luck, humanity, serendipity, but you also describe in the book how you had a moment of clarity lying there that
very much, yeah.
Something bigger was at play here. Mm. Take us back to that moment.
Yeah, absolutely. Even if I have to just reflect back to all the little miracles that happened that day, having met Crystal the day before, shared phone numbers, he recognized the kit I was wearing because I had a special kit made for the race. I wore the same kit the day before. That type of thing. The people that were there, the head of ICU that was in the referee's car, it was the first year he was in the referee's car. So had he not been there, what would have happened? Who knows? So all these little things, and in my opinion, God was definitely in control of that morning. I've always been a believer, so for me, he was in control of what was happening there. Yeah, it was just wonderful to just have a few moments of absolute peace and tranquility in His presence as I stopped breathing, couldn't see anything, couldn't hear anything. Couldn't feel anything, and it was just total peace. It was beautiful.
What you woke up to the next day, though, was anything but. So Grant, you come to an Italian hospital, your brother is at your side, who has been driven through the night from Holland to get there, your mom is en route from South Africa,
yeah.
And an ICU specialist says to you, dude, you must be alive for a reason, nobody should have survived what you've just gone through. I mean, that kind of comment, I think, obviously, I don't know if it was that particular comment, but that sense of, there's a purpose to this now, why am I still here, why did I survive this, so many people wouldn't have. Was that a turning point? Was it that person's comment, or was that thought already seeded in your head that I'm here, I can't believe I'm awake and I'm alive, there's got to be some reason for it? Where did that thought process start? Because that is really what became the second life of Grant Lawton.
Yeah, but that was definitely Marco when he kind of sat with me, the head of ICU, and he said, you survived death, you're the first person I can tell that to. There's a reason you're alive, it's up to you what you do with it. And that was the last time I saw him. Well, I have seen him since, but that while I was there in Italy. And when he left that evening, we sat and spoke for quite a while, and we replayed the whole thing. But that night when he left, I went from being a patient and a victim to being a very, very determined patient to get out of there and to prove the doctors wrong. Because the guys in ICU at high care, they were adamant I won't ride again. I wanted to know exactly what happened to me. We even got a translator in there at some point. And, you know, it's one thing to say you cannot do it again, but it's up to that person whether they're going to accept it or not. And I was not prepared to accept it. So definitely, it started with what Marco told me. And there I realized, but yeah, stop whining and feeling angry and sorry and disappointed it's happened to you. Get a grip and get strong. Work with a physio, work with the doctors, do whatever you can to get out of here as quickly as you can. Because they told me back then, I said, you cannot fly home. We're going to have to arrange an ambulance to drive you to your brother in Holland. You're going to have to recuperate there. And then at some point you can fly back to South Africa. Your lungs are too bad, your thorax, all that stuff. And the minute I made that mental switch of, I'm going to get better, I'm going to overcome this, I'm going to get home as quick as I can, that's where I started to recover. So it started there for sure.
But then, and sort of two strings to that recovery. One is determination that I will ride again, and not just ride on a bicycle for a Sunday stroll. You decided right then and there, I'm coming back to Italy, I'm going to finish this race. The second thing was, of course, this decision of, I'm going to live my life a different way, with purpose and with intent. And I mean, okay, so either you're just pig-headedly stubborn, or there is more to this absolute conviction that you were going to get back on the bike again. But why the need to go back and finish that race? I mean, a lot of people would have said, well, my ambition is to be able to ride again and leave it at that. You go, I want to ride, and I want to ride that race that's just nearly killed me, and soon. Talk to us about, I mean, what was it about that race you felt you had to finish it?
Yeah, I think there was definitely a bit of a big-headed stubbornness going on there, definitely. Because if you tell me something, if you tell me I can't do something, I will find a way to prove you wrong. I've always been like that. Even if it's at my own expense, I will find a way to prove you wrong. Don't tell me what I can and can't do, that I'm not able to. So that really drove me, but I was determined by the time I reached home, 21 days later, I was determined that I don't want my life to go back to the way it was. I'd already started thinking about how can I make my life meaningful. Talking to audiences was not in the back of my mind at all. I didn't even think about it. However, I knew I can use this talent to do something with it. Because I never understood the power of my talent, and I started using it to make a difference. So that became my drive, and I thought, well, you know, I mean, some of the doctors said, we'll get you back on your bike, but it's not going to be this year, it's not going to be next year, it'll be a few years. And I thought, but then what? It's like, oh, I had an accident 3 years ago and I went back to finish the race. Whoopee, that's really not such a big deal. And I thought, no, it has to be the very next year, because I had a whole plan around it. And that's when I made contact with Laureus. And we got Jim Banny here, he's a trustee member of Laureus. And I'd always followed them because I love what they do with kids and sport and that, and knowing how sport affected me as a boy. And I remember I went to speak to one of the guys down there at the Laureus office, told him I'm going back, this is what happened to me, and I want to raise some money for you guys, how can I go about it? And I got the idea, let me just, how many mountains am I riding over in Italy? It's 4 mountains, I'm going to sell them to corporates. I was still working at the bank, all my clients were corporate. I went to all of them, they all said, sure, we'll support you. 10 grand here, 15 grand there, and I started raising money. And when at the time I went back to do the ride, there was a lot of pressure on me that I put on myself. But the support I had because of that tenacity and refusal to accept my circumstance. And a lot of people thought, you are absolutely mad to go back so soon because you haven't recovered yet. But to me, it was about more than that. It was not just about that. It was about, so what if I do pull this off and we raise a good couple of hundred or whatever it was, I can't remember now. Wouldn't it be worthwhile? Wouldn't it be a good story? So that's what drove me.
And it was worthwhile just to be able to read the paragraph of finishing that race a year later. So, I mean, yeah, everybody was telling him not to go. The doctors are telling you, you're not ready. You're crazy. We don't support this. We don't endorse this. And it wasn't an easy race. Spoiler alert, it was a hard, hard trip, and it wasn't as fast as you might have initially hoped to do the race. But, I mean, your description of finishing and entering that last straight and seeing your brother Glenn at the finish line with his camera ready. And I just want to quickly read, if I may. His camera pointed back at me, capturing the moment as arms above my head, tears streaming down my sweat-covered cheeks. I crossed the line, celebrating like I'd just won the Tour de France, because in a way that's exactly what I'd done. I'd taken on the biggest challenge of all, and I'd made it against the odds. The emotion of that moment, especially obviously having your brother there to celebrate it with you, but I mean, what went through your head when you crossed that line, Grant?
Yeah, it was, I actually cannot remember. It was just so emotional, you know, because there are so many people and nobody knows what happened to this guy crossing the line with his arms in the air. And he's like, he's probably in the last quarter of the event to finish, you know. But for me and my brother, it just meant so much. My thoughts did go to my mom, though. It's my mom sitting over there, because she was absolutely terrified of her son going back so soon. Because she was my full-time nurse, you know. And shortly after this, we were able to phone her and to say, hey, I've just finished. We did it. Everything went well. But for me, the main moment for me, Papa, during that race was the high point of the race, the Col de Galibier, which that's also a life-changing point for me in terms of my future. Because I rode up the Col de Galibier. The summit is at 2,600 meters. It's a 34-kilometer ascent. It took me over 2 hours to get up there. I stopped, I don't know how many times. It was so difficult. Yet when I got to the summit, you know, you're in the moment, you're in pain. When you ride like that, you tend to just look down at your wheel in front of you. But I stopped and I looked around and I saw the snow-capped peaks around me and I'm above the cloud line. And I see all the people still riding up behind me and it just hit me. Look where you are. Look what you've achieved here. Even if the race stopped there for me, it would have been a victory. Because there I realized the power of belief. Even if you're the only one who believes you can do it, sometimes that is enough. Sometimes that's all it takes. Is that dogged determination to refuse to listen to others or let them put their limits on you and just go for it, even if there's no sign to prove that, yes, you'll be able to do it. Just got to believe and trust it's going to work out. So that to me was the main moment. The finish line was just pure joy and happiness, you know. The fact that I was tired and pain, it just meant nothing. It was just, we did it. And Glenn, I mean, he sobbed. Never seen my brother cry so much before. Wow, it's beautiful.
And then Grant the Masochist arrives because you decide I'm going to do it and keep on doing it and set myself harder and harder challenges and longer endurance feats because you've realized this is about more than me and there is something meaningful I can do with this. So Grant, it becomes less about your personal redemption story, whatever you want to call it, of finishing that race, and becomes now, okay, how do we up the bar? How do we raise more money for Laureus? How do I make it count and get the headlines and the attention that allows us to keep that traction going? So to paraphrase a good third or quarter of the book, you go on to set yourself every year a tougher and tougher and tougher target. Higher mountains, more of them, always against the clock. You didn't allow yourself any leeway of, oh, we'll see if we can finish it. It was, I've got to do this distance, that kind of vertical ascent, and it's got to be done in first 24 hours, then 48 hours. And they got longer and longer and tougher and tougher. I mean, it's one thing to decide on doing a massively challenging endurance ride. That comes with having to put yourself out there in the build-up to those rides, to do the publicity, to raise the sponsor interest. It requires putting yourself front and center. And I know that's not a place where you're comfortable being. In some ways, reading this book, I realized that maybe that was the hardest part for you, that actually going through the physical pain, going through the mental barriers of setting yourself these challenges and riding the race, you first had to get over that sense of wanting to not be the guy in the spotlight. I mean, how big an adjustment was it for you? Because you've got to do the one in order to make the other work.
That is so true. Yeah, as much as I needed encouragement to sit here today with a book, I needed encouragement to start sharing my story beyond just on the bike and on social media. even since I was a kid, I was always in the background. I was not a social animal. I didn't have a big circle of friends. And I certainly didn't enjoy talking about myself. I would rather just listen to other people and ask people about them. So for me to go on stage and talk about me, initially I was very hesitant to do that. But then I realized, but maybe it's not actually about you, Grant. It's about doing something to help other people. And the tool that you're using is the bike. But the message through that of inspiring people, of instilling a sense of hope amongst people, especially young people as well, we really need it today. Maybe it's more about that. And I got some help from a few very, very good friends now. Dan Eagle's one of them, who helped me share my story, giving me some tips. Joel Stransky was another guy. And they sort of like opened that door for me. And I started working closer with Laureus, getting more ideas around continuing the fundraising and all that. So I just shifted my focus from, it's actually not about me, it's about inspiring others. And you do have a story. That's why I kept pushing my boundary every year to make it more compelling, to make it more powerful, but also to show people that you can have a positive expectation, you can live in hope, and you can push your own boundaries, and you can overcome, even when the circumstances don't necessarily show that you will. And that's the message I wanted to get through. So it made it a lot easier for me to then go on stage. And one of the first stages I had to go on was a Springbok team, which I almost had a heart attack. But that really was a big stretch, bigger than riding 1,000 kilometers on a bike, you know.
Not just rugby players.
But just their reaction, their reaction afterwards was just, and I left it and I realized, but you do have a message to share, Grant. You do.
I think where I found perhaps even deeper respect for you, I mean, huge respect after that first interview, realizing, hearing the injuries you'd suffered, realizing you'd gone back.
Yeah.
But I think even more powerful for me was the year you set yourself the challenge and you didn't make it. Things didn't go according to plan. And you came back and went, okay, what's next? Where do we go next year? Mm. Take us back to that one, because I mean, the I'm Possible tours have been glowing successes. You've raised millions of rands along the way. You've talked up one tick, 24-hour challenge tick, 48-hour tennis tick. You kept on going and going. You seemed superhuman, and then life hands you a bit of a clap. Was it the 2017 one? I think that didn't really go the way it was planned.
Quite right. Yeah, I suppose we all need to come down to earth now and then, don't we? But. Yeah, things were going really well. I mean, 2015, I did my first 24-hour ride. That was the first big one for me where I rode through the night. I'd never done that before. And today, so many cyclists do it. We're doing it Friday night. I'm doing it with 500 others in the Oudtshoorn in the Karoo. Everybody's doing it, but through the Alps, a different story. I came back from that one, had another surgery. 2016 was the first year that I didn't have to have a surgery before a tour. That was a 1,000K tour, very successful. And then immediately I started thinking, how can I double it? Is it possible? Started working on that. Then I had to get emergency surgery later that year. And then I started planning 2017, which should have taken me about 4 days through the Alps. But Mother Nature was against me. And I ended up getting hypothermia after about 20 hours on the bike, and I had to stop. And there was a lot of pressure on me then because it was a very, very big ride I was attempting. Lots of sponsorships, lots of commitments for donating upon completion, okay, which didn't happen. But yeah, that was terribly disappointing to not be able to finish that tour. Came back to South Africa, and I just knew I had to get my head back in the game immediately. And that's the thing, when you're so driven, you've got to have a goal. So every time I achieve a goal, I have to get a new goal. And I went back to Europe, and I drove the length of the Pyrenees and the Alps, and I found a beautiful route, and I figured I'm going to do the Pyrenees and the Alps in 2018, which was incredibly difficult, but I managed to succeed with that. So. Yeah, it was just, I needed to get myself a new goal very, very quickly. So remember, I've got sponsors. You know, I've got Mercedes-Benz, I've got Emirates, I've got all these sponsors. They want their media exposure. So I put myself under a lot of pressure for that in order to provide that to them.
So my question is, how much longer you keep doing that? Because I mean, Grant, nobody could fault you if you were to walk away, put down the microphone today and say, that's it, I'm done. You've done more than anybody imagined you ever would. You've raised, as I said, millions of rands for charity. You've achieved those personal goals. You've proved to yourself you have what it takes. And yet you show no sign of walking away at any point soon. I mean, at some point, there's going to come a time where 24-hour challenges, 48-hour challenges are just too much. Is your plan to push yourself as long as you can until physically you've got to stop? Or what is your thinking in that regard?
No, definitely not. You know, I mean, last year was my 10th one. I did 3 tours last year, in fact. First one, South Africa, beginning of the year, and a big one in the US through Southern California, which was a beautiful challenge. 53 hours, though, it took a lot out of me. And then I did one in the French Alps, which I needed to stop after 17 hours. It would have been a 24-hour ride. My nervous system started shutting down. I just overdid it completely. My body was just shutting down, really. So I realized last year was a wake-up call for me. I always knew I cannot continue doing all this right. So I've been working on that, and I've had this beautiful idea about doing an event, and we tried that before COVID, and that didn't happen, and learned a lot from it. A lot of mistakes were made, and so it's still in my mind. I'm definitely moving more towards speaking and building my profile in the US. It's a big focus this year and next year. But also to start doing events and involve people, involve communities. And I'm going to start here in South Africa, working quite aggressively on that now. More or less around 24-hour type of relay events. Something that a lot of people can participate in. So no, for me to do these 3-4 day tours, I don't have that desire anymore either. It's time to focus on something different, but build from the platform that's been created.
Yeah. I mean, do you still suffer lingering physical pain from your injuries? I mean, you've said, you've had multiple surgeries. The sheer fact of your recovery is remarkable, but you don't put your body through that kind of injury and not have long-lasting effects. I mean, do you still deal with physical pain when you're back on the bike now?
Yeah, I do still, for sure, very much. Even at night when I don't sleep, I'm at the biokineticist 3-4 times a month. We're constantly working on stuff. Now we're working on the nerves in my SIJ going through my hip. That's affecting my leg and all that stuff. So there's always something. But it's being a sportsman. I mean, but
it's also getting older. I mean, as I said to a friend this morning, some days you sneeze and you pull something.
I was hoping you wouldn't go there. No, I'm not getting older.
Of course
not. Maybe grayer, but not older.
There's enough hair for us to tell, so you're safe.
You know, I would also love to be a very good example for not just young people, but people my age, people in the 50s. 50s and you're young. I mean, the type of races guys in their 50s are doing in this country, it's unbelievable. 10, 15 years ago, it was unheard of. Everybody's got that drive now to push themselves personally, physically, and there are more than enough events to be able to do it. And I would like to think I'm a good example of someone in his 50s. I'm turning 55 next month, good Lord. But I don't feel as though I cannot do it anymore. I do believe I still can. Whether the passion is there now, the drive, different story. But no, I think the physical body, if you look after it, if your mind is strong and you determine, Andrew there as well. Andrew, you're heading off to Europe in August, eh, to do Paris-Brest, 600 something cases, non-stop. Yeah, so there's a lot of guys my age or older. Sorry, I don't want to. That are pushing themselves physically to a hell of an extent. It's a wonderful thing. It's great.
Mm-hmm. I'm kind of relieved because I was almost too scared to ask what the next challenge is going to be. Because chapter after chapter, I go, surely not. Surely at some point you slow down. Mm-hmm. So, but slowing down is not necessarily stopping. It's finding a different way of doing it and increasing the scope of the reach of it. So, I mean. Yeah. 30 years from now, when you look back, if I was to ask you right now, what's the moment you're proudest of? What's the thing you're proudest of? Is it the personal journey? Is it the money you've raised? Right now, what is it and what do you hope it'll be in 30 years' time?
I cannot say it's the money I've raised because it's become very, very difficult, especially since COVID. It's become so difficult. Hence, I'm working on different events now where it's not about Grant to see how far I can ride and Grant running alone. It's about involving people, and that opens different methods of raising funds through a non-profit company, that type of thing. So we're working on that. So for me, it's I'm proud of that, but I would have loved to raise much more. So I raised 424 rand per kilometer in all my tours. That I'm proud of, but I would have loved it to be much more. But for me personally, I would say my proudest moment is, you know, it's just when I get a message on Facebook, on Messenger, and I still do get them frequently, where someone saw my story on TV, on Kierpunt or wherever, or they watched my YouTube documentary or whatever it is, and it inspired their child at home, or it inspired them to get back on the bike, or them to get over what happened to them. Just those messages, personal messages from people I don't know from a bar soap, who contact me and thank me for inspiring them. That to me is the proudest moment. That makes me feel like, it's been worth it, all that pain and suffering on a bike, giving up your career, starting from scratch, building a new life, reinventing my life quite literally. That makes it so worth it. I'm not even close to where I want to be, but that's what keeps me going. You know, all those messages and that, and even now with the book reviews we're getting and comments I'm getting from people, it's beautiful. It's really rewarding.
So I've got one more question of my own before we open to the floor, and it's to your mom. Have you forgiven him for what he's put you through all of these years?
Which was? Warrior and Benny can stay away.
All worry and panic and do what moms do. No, all credit to you for the supports and for the nursing in the immediate aftermath. But for, I mean, the bond with your family is clear in this book, Grant, and it's obvious that, I mean, they must have had moments of going, are you really going to put us through this again?
Yeah, especially my brother as well now, very, very special. Yeah, that's one thing I realized. I mean, just a closing statement from me to back to the hospital. You know, I didn't lie there and think about my work and my car and all that other stuff. I was thinking about my health, my family, my friends. Because those are the things that's not replaceable. Okay, friends, you make new friends, you lose some. But to have that close friendship, that close inner circle of friends, you know, those are the things that's really important in life, isn't it? So, yeah, that really also had a big change in the way I look at life and the way I approach life. That material stuff, it's important, but
it's not what really matters, yeah. Well, I want to say thank you for finally sharing your story in this form, because as you know, as often as I've told it on radio, to read it and go deep into what you actually went through was on another level. I mean, I raced, pardon the pun, raced through this book in one night, Grant, and I think many people are going to be the same. I'd love to invite audience members who are still have this ride ahead of them, but probably have questions of their own. I think we're small enough, we don't need microphones to travel. Just anybody would like to say anything, ask anything, know anything, just stick a hand up. Yeah?
Andrew?
So I don't know if you're placing this in historical context. In 1903, there was a Frenchman called Henri Lagrange, who became the founder of the Tour de France. He went out and plotted the routes where Grant rode, the Galibier and the Tourmalet and all of those in the Pyrenees and the Alps. And he got a special group of riders to go and do them, race them. And he knew that he had an event that was going to capture the imagination of the world for the tour. When a few of the cyclists came past him on one of the climbs, and someone shouted out, "You sadist." And he knew then, I'm going to capture this event, I'm going to make this into the most heroic thing for the next 100 years that's going to just bring out these champions and these warriors. And around that time, there were a group of cyclists who wanted to get in there, but they were at the back of the field. They were much slower. They could never become a Tour de France champion like an Eddy Merckx or Bernard Hinault, but they could ride huge distances over multiple days, but slow. And so they decided to create an event called, which they didn't actually have a name for it at that time, but they were just going town to town. So they were going Montpellier to Lyon or whatever, and doing 400, 500 kilometers at a time, slowly, with the guys that could approach that speed. And when they were going through one town, a Frenchman shouted out, "Where have you been? Where are you going?" And one of them said, "We are going from Marseille to Lyon," or whatever. And this guy said, "That's audacious." And so hence the word audax came from that. And this has become the kind of mirror image to the Tour de France and the top racing guys, was these guys that could go and ride enormously long distances, not as fast, but they would do incredible feats. And I just want to say, to bring this back to Grant, you've been so inspiring to so many of us for so many years now, since 2013, because you've actually become this embodiment of someone that can race and do these incredible feats at high speeds up the Galibier, race, take on the 21-year-old, the 23 world champion, and you're twice his age, and you're going to try and race against him and show what you can do. And in your second incarnation of your life, you've gone from being the Tour de France type racing guy to also being the audax guy that can set these challenges of multiple hours. And I have to say that, and I've been around racing for a while and cycling for a while, there's very few athletes on the planet that do both and inspire people in the way that you have done it. So hats off and raise glasses to you, Grant, because you are an incredible inspiration. And thank you for your story.
I appreciate that. Thank you. I walk on water, by the way.
We'd never have guessed. Are there any other questions from the audience? I think you you've nailed it. Audacious. Audacious is the word, Grant. I think you've got to wear that as part of your laureus crown. I mean, that is that is the word that sums up. It's being bold enough to say, I won't take no for an answer. And the inspiration even to couch potatoes is there. I mean, I hear in Andrew's comment how much it's meant to the cycling community. But I think this book is going to take it to another level because it is going to reach people who wouldn't have been that aware of your story, who wouldn't have understood the impact and the details and the depth of what it is you've actually achieved.
It's
rather
not
than
actually a cycling story.
It's not a cycling story.
Yeah.
It's not a cycling book. And when we talk again on my show on Friday, I'm going to make a point of saying that this is a book that should be read by non-cyclists as much as by cyclists. So good luck for the third phase of Grant Lottering's life. And I'm so glad that you've taken the time, and if we have to be grateful for something out of COVID, let it be that this book finally came into existence. And thank you for joining us tonight.
And I want to thank you, Pippa, and I want to thank all of you for taking the time to be here, and Alan for making the venue available. It's a privilege for me to share, and I've got family and friends, and it's really special. So thank you very much, and your support all these years.
It's been my pleasure.
You're going to have something more to
do. Armchair cyclist of notes, so I've lived vicariously.
Yeah,
I don't think I've ever written more than 2 hours at the street.
Right, thank you so much, everyone. Really
please buy the book, everybody. You will not regret it.
Thank you for joining us on ND Publishers Book Nook. Riding Life is available from leading bookstores nationwide or online. Until next time, and happy reading.